move now from how the centenary was imagined to what was actually done. The digitisation of repatriation records was the first, and it was the unanimous recommendation of that panel of historians in Canberra. And actually, I think it was the only point that 12 historians locked in a room in Canberra could actually agree on, and none of you will be surprised by that. Now, to date, very few people have viewed these records, and the sample taken by historians has been very small. So what I want to do first is to walk you through some of these files and explain why their digitisation has to be so urgent a priority for the centenary. I'm going to argue tonight that these files are by their very nature disruptive to a simplistic and unproblematised view of the past and of war. And then I'm going to introduce you to some of the ways historians might use these and other archival records, the 100 Stories project I mentioned a moment ago. Okay, my first task then, a brief overview of the repat records. Now, you'll find many images of Australian servicemen and women on the National Archives website. The site's recently been rebadged. It's now called Discovering Our Anzacs. And that in itself is testimony to the way that thousands of Australians have connected through the keyboard to an imagined Anzac past. They visit this site to view the service dossier of a man or woman that went to war and thus insert their family story within a wider national narrative. Discovering Anzacs also provides a space for visitors to upload images like this one and record family memories. Of course, two or three generations on, these are not really memories at all. For the historian, can I say, these images highlight the selective nature of war remembrance. Invariably, the portraits the site hosts seem to be so handsome, so heroic. They remind us what Anna Carden Coyne has called the sterilisation of war and violence. These clean, whole and beautiful bodies conceal the sordid reality of bodies damaged, dismembered, altogether obliterated by war. So, the image I want to begin with isn't that familiar image of young, confident soldiers, proud and handsome, but an image of one of those men when he comes back from war, scarred by the experience of battle, aged prematurely by the terrible things he has seen and he has done, he's not just a victim, and struggling to adjust to a new life as a civilian. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Bertram Burns. Private Burns, the service record tells us, enlisted at the age of 24. He served in France. He was wounded in action two times. The second wound did this, September 1918, the attack at Mont-Saint-Quentin. Private Burns's service dossier runs for just 22 pages, that's all. There's only one letter from him, one chance for him to speak. It's this letter, written in 1938, asking to purchase duplicates of his service medals lost in a bushfire. He wanted to wear them on Anzac Day. Now, reading the service dossier will tell you little about Private Burns or his family or his wound or what it actually did to him. The repatriation records are so much more substantial. Three separate files, hundreds and hundreds of pages, and they tell us so much more. What does that sparse entry in the service record, GSW, face, really mean? The medical report in the repatriation files refers to much facial disfigurement. I think Private Burns put it much better than that. My face is practically shot away. That wound was so severe that he dribbled constantly and there was a discharge from his nose. Private Burns had to live on what we could call slop food. His disfigurement, much worse before that operation, was such that employers wouldn't take him on. He was shunned, ostracised, took up a block of land as a soldier settler, found himself too weak to work it. Reading the service record, you would learn nothing of that, nothing of his or his family's post-war ordeal. The repatriation records and, of course, the soldier settlement records held here in New South Wales tell us this, and they tell us so much more. At the moment, the experience of war is recorded in a kind of shorthand, and one that often lends itself to that proud, heroic narrative we talked about a moment ago. But the repatriation files help us to imagine what those of us who have never been to war can never understand. And there is a visceral quality to that. You read these men's accounts, often in their own words, and you can begin to imagine what it must have been like to spend days and nights in continuous fever and delirium, a shaking and a shivering, as the file puts it. You can hear the hushed voices of what they called the whispering men, gassed men whose lungs were slowly corroding, who could barely breathe, who vomited up their meals, who fell over with giddiness, and like this man, finally lost any confidence in himself. You can see the physical and the emotional scars of what was called a war-wrecked generation, and how their injuries also destroyed the lives of those around them. Leroy, that gas man in the previous slide, turns to drink, and he turns on his wife as well. Now, you might think that's an unmitigated tragedy, an endless catalogue of horrors, but history, we all know, is never just that. There is, I think, a great dignity in Bertram Burns. Look at the way this man dressed on the day they took that photograph. Read about the efforts he makes to provide for his family. And remember that this is a man who wanted to wear his medals on Anzac Day and who would be seen. But his battles didn't end in 1918. Well, two things to notice about this prize, no door guys prizes for guessing. Look at this phrase, sentenced to destruction. When the repatriation records came to the National Archives from the Department of Veterans Affairs, archives had to decide, what are we going to do with them? And frankly, they posed a huge problem, and I mean huge quite literally, 10 kilometres of shelving space. Can you imagine that? That's a veritable forest of files. And as is so often the case with bureaucracies, people clutched for the easiest solution. I mean, who'd want to read the medical charts of long-dead men? And maybe there are awkward issues of privacy somewhere here. And so for several months, the fate of those files hung in the balance. And can I just pay tribute to the historians and the archivists back then, and back then wasn't so long ago, 2004, who saved these remarkable records from destruction. But the second thing I want you to notice is the name. Thomas Abdullah's name is telling us something we don't often hear about the first AIF. Its social and its cultural diversity. I think that's a story we need to recover today if we're going to say something new about the Great War in this country. Now, Thomas Abdullah's name stands out. But in most cases, the ethnic and cultural diversity of the first AIF was concealed by the service record. Recruits are described as British subjects, and often there's no clue to Indian, Chinese, Indigenous descent. Because the repatriation records are fuller accounts, because they're embedded in community, because they're a record of families as much as veterans, they offer these kind of insights. Now, I mentioned a moment ago the visceral quality of the testimony, but how do these files facilitate new historical understandings? Well, firstly, there's the potential for intergenerational health studies. Few other countries in the world possess so comprehensive a health record for so large a cross-section of the population. And I'm not just talking about veterans here. When former servicemen and women lodged a pension claim, they answered detailed questions, not just about their own health, but also the health of their families. The department had to determine if a condition was war-related or if it was congenital. Recent work by Janet McCullman has demonstrated the potential of these intergenerational studies. By digitising our records, Australia will be showcasing one of our richest archives to a global digital community, and will be making history more accessible to local communities as well. Second point, the repatriation records are not just about the health of a nation. They're an insight into the society of their day. They tell us about a neglected phase in Australian history, the role of the state in the interwar period, the intervention of the medical expert into the life of the individual citizen, the working of public welfare and private charity. They demonstrate, as Marina Larson and L. Thompson's work has shown us, how war reaches into and how it damages the social fabric. And for a Labor historian like myself, they reveal a great deal about a generation told to sacrifice so much, but really given so little in return. Promised a land fit for heroes, but often sent to work marginal land. Men and women unable to find remunerative employment, often as a direct result of their injuries. I used to cough and spit so much, they always found some excuse to discharge me. Reliant on inadequate pensions, and forced into the position of supplicants. Men like Harry here, who even had to bludge a smoke. Imagine the indignity of that, bludging a smoke from another wounded mate. And these records span a vast political and emotional range. In an article published last May in Labor History, Melanie Oppenheimer and I explore what we've called the moral economy, thank you, Alan Atkinson, of Australia's soldier settlers, their assertion of their rights, this outraged sense of entitlement as citizens and as veterans. I won't go into this study in any detail, not with Alan here, but I will mention the case of a man who, like so many other soldier settlers, was burdened by a huge debt from the government the very moment he took up his block. Now, the government did a tally of exactly how much this man owed the state, and they sent him a bill for several hundred pounds. In response, this particular soldier settler itemised not just every hour of the day he worked on the farm, but also the cost of going to the Great War, the cost, he reckoned, of his injuries, the cost in lost earnings, and he sent the government a much bigger bill of his own. And he declared that every working man has a right to a working wage in and out of uniform, and he demanded the government make fit its promise, "You promised us a land fit for heroes." I mention this article for two reasons. One, because it's another chance to acknowledge the importance of collaborative research. And two, it highlights something immensely important about the digitisation project. We have an opportunity now as historians to triangulate sources, to shift from service dossier, from repatriation file, to lands department records, to have a much fuller and much more nuanced understanding of the men and women before and after they went to war. One final point. We've looked at how these men survived the war. Repatriation records show us how they struggled to survive the peace. And that, I hasten to add, is not just a man's story. As this remarkable letter from Don Carney suggests, she tells us the widow of Don Carney. She tells us what it's like to live on the poverty line, pleading just a little help at Christmas time, offering that insight into the intermediate economy of veterans' families. Women's voices are threaded all through the repatriation files, and it's on a woman's voice that I want to end this part of the lecture on tonight. This is a letter from Louisa Campbell. She's writing to the department not long after the death of her husband. Lieutenant A.B. Campbell came back from the war with severe respiratory problems, many men did, and she writes with an intimacy that I find quite disarming. "My husband's death was the death of all my happiness. He was no whiner. He hid his sufferings with a smile." Well, the circumstances of Lieutenant Campbell's death are by no means clear, but it was a violent death, as violent to the death as you will ever encounter in war. Lieutenant Campbell's body was cut in two when he fell from a railway carriage between Wynyard and Town Hall Station here in Sydney. He may have opened that door because he was desperate for air, both his lungs were collapsing, every breath was an effort. Or he may have, as the coroner's report implies, chosen a quicker death than the one that was in store. What is beyond dispute is that Louisa Campbell believed that his death was directly attributable to his war service. "He gave his life for his country," she writes, "as surely as if he had died in battle. We did our bit." The department thought otherwise. Campbell's death was deemed not war-related. Her pension was assessed accordingly. And maybe that's the most important message of these extraordinary records. It is not just soldiers in uniform that bear the cost of war. Mrs. Campbell's testimony introduces me to the third topic of this evening, the 100 Stories Project, relied very much on these repatriation records. The project was designed to broaden the ambit of remembrance, to face some of the uncomfortable truths we've been talking about just now. And they had their genesis in the first tentative meetings of the Anzac Centenary Board in Canberra. Some members of the board were captivated by the suggestion that the names of Australia's war dead might be projected in lights across our war memorials and maybe over the sails of the Opera House as well. We can do that. And some went even further than that. I mean, why stop at our war dead? We should include New Zealand fatalities. There is, after all, an NZ in Anzac. I know, this could be a global partnership, a continuous screening over 5 years of the centenary of every casualty of the war. Have we got time to fit them all in? One government official meekly asked. The truth of it is, of course, that the war dead, all the war dead, can never be named. We can never know the names of legions of Ottoman soldiers slaughtered at Anzac. There were no surnames in the Ottoman Empire, and what records there were scattered and destroyed in decades of continuous war. Who bothered to record the names of African soldiers fighting for one or another imperial colonial power? As Siegfried Sassoon once remarked, the appalling thing about the Great War is its sweeping anonymity, so many nameless names. And then there's the matter of naming itself, isn't there? So important in the 1920s to restore individuals to the family who's lost them. But today, can naming serve that same purpose? or are these names no longer really ours? And finally, just who qualifies as our war dead? Australia's official honour roll, those names gleaming in bronze at the heart of our war memorial, number 60,000 for World War I. But what about the men and women who died decades after the fighting had ended? Were they not casualties as well? What about Lieutenant Campbell? The 100 stories began as a corrective to all that, and one I should add strongly supported at first by some members of the board. They offered a fragment of Australia's war experience, 100 lives to symbolise the centenary. The stories were chosen from right across the country. They highlight the experience of women as well as men. They consider the way the war affected a generation. I'm going to trial just a couple of these stories today. They're very short. The first fell just within the comfort zone of the Anzac Centenary Board, but the second two mark a point of departure. Historians were asked, and I quote here, why is there a need to be so brutally honest? Now, that's an interesting question, isn't it? And it begs another question, doesn't it? Do you really want a dishonest history of the Great War? And we were told that the confronting stories were simply too challenging. One story, as you'll see in particular, those stories should be replaced by what was called positive nation-building stories. Tonight, you'll have the opportunity to decide that for yourselves. But first, a word of explanation. These are silent presentations. Their purpose is to distill the archives. They rely on the written word. And silence is actually a deliberate play on the commemorative space of remembrance. Go to Hyde Park, you know what I mean. It's a way of inviting the viewer to consider what we forget when we remember war. Finally, I am all too aware of this medium's limitations. A 2-minute digital presentation can't do justice to the complexities of the past and the nuances of meaning that so intrigue us as historians. That's why this digital history is being accompanied by a book-length study. It'll be launched in Melbourne on Remembrance Day this year, and you are all warmly invited to come. And Meg, you must excuse the limitations of our first attempt at digital history. Here we go. I hope. Runs for less than 6 minutes. Thank you. Could we have the lights up again now, please? It's not his fault. It's not his fault. No one hurried to condemn Frank Wilkinson in the 1920s. Perhaps because Australia was full of similar stories, equally tragic. Good men, undone by the horrors of war, brutalised by what they had seen and what they had done. The question is really whether we're prepared to hear these stories today. Wilkinson's story was a story that went too far. This was the story we were asked to replace with some more consoling tale, what Wilfred Owen would have called some gallant lie. Over the next few years of the centenary, there's going to be no shortage of nation-building narratives, believe me. We will be told time and time again a story of courage and sacrifice, fortitude and endurance, mateship and resolve. But perhaps 100 years on, there is space for other stories too. Perhaps we should seek out stories that have been marginalised by those very nation-building narratives. Perhaps for this global catastrophe we call the Great War, we should look beyond the boundaries of the nation. One senior bureaucrat told me in Canberra that what the public hopes for from this centenary is, and I quote, a warm, fuzzy feeling. I actually believe he's wrong about that. I believe the public is ready for a more mature, more reflective mode of remembrance than the Anzac amnesia we are so often served. In any event, historians cannot be party to so willfully selective view of the past. That diminishes history, but of course it diminishes them as well. And now to the finest and I promise the briefest part of my paper. Many of the men who served on Gallipoli went on to the Western Front, and it's there that I want to end this evening's lecture. Late last year, Jay Winter, Ray Francis, L. Thompson and I were asked to provide historical content for the new interpretive centre that is being planned for Villabretno. You've all heard about it. Just 3 months into this immensely important project, Australia's showpiece for the centenary, we decided to withdraw. And I would just like to briefly explain why. You see, we believe that remembering the Great War should be a transnational project, rather like the European project itself. 100 years since the carnage that tore the world apart, it's surely time to speak across the borders, to focus on the common tragedy shared by combatants and civilians on all sides of the conflict. Now, that actually doesn't fit very well with the brief that the new interpretive centre should demonstrate the way the first AIF and John Monash in particular won the war. And that's a claim that politicians will make time and time again over the next few years. Nor were we encouraged by some of the comments made by senior government officials. There are certain feelings we want to instill in the centre, one senior official told us, and that effective use of history is probably worrying enough. But even more worrying are the feelings that he hoped to create. Quiet pride was one of them, quickly moderated, he added, by just a touch of sadness. Those of you who've been to Villebretno might know that a touch of sadness is not quite enough for the Somme. The exhibition space planned for Villebretno will feature a number of biographical sketches. Today I'm going to tell you two of the stories that we nominated, and I promise this won't take long. The first is that of a man who showed a very different kind of courage to the soldiers, a man who spoke out against the insanity of that war. Arthur Ray, founder of the Shearers Union in Australia and Aotearoa, New Zealand, one of the first Labor members of Parliament here in New South Wales. A fervent internationalist, Arthur Ray called for a negotiated peace and opposed the introduction of conscription in this country. He also had three sons who served, and two of them, William and Donald here, died. It was almost certainly Arthur Ray who composed young Billy's epitaph. It's an inscription set in stone at the very entrance of Villebretno, and it challenges, I think, every visitor to that site today. What does it say? Another life lost, hearts broken, for what? Arthur Ray's story reminds us how the Great War tore a family and a nation apart. It affirms a dissenting voice that we seem to have forgotten in our memory of that conflict. The war divided Australia and the world. It laid to waste a generation, and it laid the basis of an even more terrible war to follow. And arguably, the greatest victory for democracy to emerge from that war wasn't the defeat of Prussian militarism, but the defeat of two bitterly contested conscription referenda. Thanks in no small part to individuals like Arthur Ray, Australians affirmed a great principle. Ours was a volunteer army. No man was forced to bear arms against another. Now, I don't expect all of you to agree with all of that analysis, but I hope you'll concede that so eloquent an epitaph compels our consideration. We can't cut it out of the archive. Ray, by the way, was allowed 66 letters to express his grief, and for that he was charged threepence halfpenny for each letter and the spaces between every word, as if he'd not already given enough. The second story, like the first, comes from the 100 Stories Project. Charlie Kingston is the man in the centre of this photograph. When this picture was taken, he was the officer commanding the War Graves Attachment at Villebretno. Again, you can't really leave a man like that out of the story. Indeed, Kingston and his men laid the basis of the cemetery that stands there to this day. Now, I don't need to explain to you how gruesome that work must have been. The recovery of bodies scattered across the killing fields, all in a state of advanced decay. Kingston and his men were volunteers. No doubt they stayed on in France for many reasons, but several, Charlie Kingston included, felt, I think, a deep sense of obligation. Burying a man you may have known with some semblance of dignity was an attempt to restore human decency in a war where surely all decency was lost. But Charlie, rather like Arthur Ray, presents us with a dissenting narrative, one that problematises history. The war's over, he tells his men. Don't you call me sir. He dresses the German prisoners he's been allocated in Australian uniforms, sparing the abuse of the locals, and he takes them on joyrides into Amiens. He shouts them a drink. Well, several drinks, actually. He went well beyond that lethal second bottle, believe me. Under Kingston's command, the War Graves Depot at Villebretno goes by the name, and I quote here, of Captain Charlie's Boozer. And it's frequented by what locals called loose women as well. Charlie turns a blind eye while soldiers entertained women in the compound and borrowed war commissioned vehicles for excursions into the town. And when he's not burying the dead, what's Charlie doing? He's mixing what he called the Villa Bretonneau cocktail. Now, this is a potent blend of rum, whiskey and sauce of an alcoholic intensity imaginable only in France. In 1922, the government initiates an official inquiry into the management of Villa Bretonneau. Kingston is accused of behaviour unbecoming an officer, and he's sent home. He's sent home by the same military authorities who decorated that same man for bravery just a few years before. Of course, you can read Charlie's story in a number of different ways. Perhaps he was a man struggling with the demons, 3 years in the front line in Flanders and the Somme. Perhaps the drink was a desperate escape from the grim work of exhumation. Perhaps, and I think this is most likely, he'd simply had enough. No doubt you'll have your own take on that particular story. But I would like to think there was a great humanity in befriending those German prisoners and discarding the brutal authority that ordered men to their deaths. And whatever the truth of Charlie Kingston is, surely this is a story, like Arthur Ray's story, that we should today tell at Villa Bretonneau. You know where this is going. We decided to withdraw from the Villa Bretonneau project when Arthur Ray and Charlie Kingston's names were struck off the list of approved biographies. My colleagues in Melbourne, Michael McKernan and Ross McMullen, are working still with Villa Bretonneau, and they're working to replace those stories, and I hope they succeed. Now, what's at stake here, folks, is more than the professional discomfort of a few disputatious historians. At issue, can I suggest to you, is the whole nature of historical remembrance. Do we want a memory of this war that's confined to a single and unitary national narrative, or a past that is open to complexity, multiplicity, even disagreement? The museum, the Australian government assures us, will pose a major educational resource on the Western Front. If so, can we really turn away from that terrible question that Ray had carved in stone for us and future generations? And do we not do that generation a great injustice when we present them as something other than what they were? I was told just last week that the senior DVA official managing the museum has said that it would be inappropriate, I love that word, inappropriate to mention venereal disease in any historical exhibition plan for Villa Bretonneau. Honouring the dead makes them the saints they certainly never were, and ironically, it destroys their very humanity. It is, of course, an affront to history. 60,000 Australian troops contracted VD during the Great War, about the same number of the men who were killed and the largest such casualty rate in the world. Well, might we say, lest we forget, what are we actually remembering now? Well, I began this paper by discussing the shifting memory of Gallipoli. I'll end now in the same way, and thank you all for your patience. When I was asked to give this lecture, it was suggested I might consider the future of Anzac Day. How will the day be commemorated after the centenary, post-2015? Well, historians get into enough trouble puzzling over the past, let alone speculating on the future. What I will say, though, is that I truly believe, that the achievements of this centenary do actually outweigh its limitations. Why? Because those repatriation files are going to open up new fields of scholarship. They're going to enable new insights in one of the costliest conflicts of modern times, and I think they'll widen popular understandings of that war as well. And whilst Anzac may be adrift, it retains an extraordinary energy and creativity, its ability to reshape itself, its porous, shifting character, ensures its transmission and reinvention from one generation to another. I'm actually not amongst those who believe the sacrifice of the Great War has no relevance in our modern multicultural society. To the contrary, I think reflecting on Anzac and its aftermath can speak across space, across gender, across culture. And maybe that is no more clearly seen than in the Turkish Friendship Memorial we have just raised in Melbourne. The testimony of suffering soldiers from both sides, the Memechiks and the Anzacs, woven into its base. A selection of epitaphs from that generation that never ended their grieving. And, of course, the words of Hugo Throssell, VC, who took his own life 15 years after the fighting had ended. I have seen enough of the horrors of war and want peace. Thank you so much.